So welcome everyone. Today we're doing an episode on eating disorders and the kind of general topic of people reaching out for issues related to disordered eating or eating disorders, and we'll get into the kind of terminology a bit further. But we have with us today Adam Hamoud, who is a mental health social worker and is working with Safe Place Therapy. So thanks for joining us, Adam.
Pleasure, thank you.
Yeah. So I'm just, maybe as a good starting point, what is kind of interesting for you working with people who present with kind of eating disorders and come to a session with that problem?
I really enjoy working with people with eating disorders. I feel like society in general, there's such a huge stigma when they find out about someone with an eating disorder, for example, anorexia or bulimia. And I think, unfortunately, that stigma can sometimes also get transferred amongst health professionals as well. Mm-hmm. So I really do feel like it's a privilege to work with people with eating disorders, because I know how hard it must be for people to reach out and to open up. And one of my in one of my past jobs in the public mental health hospital system, I had a client who had a severe eating disorder, and I was able to work with her for over 5 years, and it really taught me a lot about the system, the eating disorder system, the mental health system, and how best to help people with eating disorders. And ever since then, I've been working with different people, you know, with different levels of severity and complexity. But I really do feel like it's a special area to work in. Yeah, so it's an interest of mine, yeah.
That's great. And I'm wondering, when our client first comes to you and reveals to you that they have an eating disorder, what are some maybe the common problems that are attached to that problem when they first start talking to you about it in session number one?
Yeah, so I think with the clients that I see, the eating, so the disordered eating or the eating disorder, it can present itself in a few different ways. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we might receive a referral from a GP or a doctor, and the reason for the referral is listed as eating disorder. So when we receive referrals such as that, we know from the get-go that that's the primary mm-hmm. topic of the treatment. And that's the focus for us to work on. On the other hand, sometimes we might get clients who they present with more general mental health type of issues, like depression, anxiety, or it could be stress or relationship issues or work issues or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it might not get disclosed in the first session. Sometimes after you build that relationship with the client and they sort of build trust in you a little bit and feel a bit more comfortable, then they might disclose later on that, you know, they do struggle with food, or, you know, whether they might be restricting or maybe they're struggling with other type of behaviors. But I think in either scenario, though, it's really, really important for the therapist to ask a lot of questions, because, I know from the client's perspective, it might feel a bit overwhelming, mm-hmm. but it really is important for the professional to try to figure out exactly what's going on, because sometimes at face value, we might not understand. You know, someone could be, you know, sometimes an eating disorder is not super obvious. Mm. You know, sometimes if someone is, you know, very, very thin or has a very low body mass index and and looks malnourished. Sometimes it's not, and to be honest, most of the time it's not that straightforward. Most of the time we see people that look, I don't like to use this word, but like normal weight, they look relatively healthy through the naked eye. So it's really important to find out what people's eating patterns are, how much they exercise, do they engage in other types of behaviors that we call like compensatory behaviors? So, purging, for example, or using laxatives, or intentionally vomiting, or going on really, really, really strict diets, and then unfortunately getting into that vicious cycle of restricting, binging, feeling really disgusted in yourself, and then promising the next day you're going to do it right. And then, yeah, some people get really stuck in those cycles. So, but it is really important to the first session, at least, just to have a proper assessment and ask a lot of questions to figure out what's going on. Yeah.
You're hinting at something really important there, Adam, which I think is the client's relationship with food, right? So if you
Yeah.
think about any food, how do they react? How do they engage with food? How often they're eating? Do they have lots of thoughts and lots of planning related to eating sessions?
Yeah.
Which can really open up the door to, does that person have a poor relationship with food? Just park the diagnosis for a sec. Does that
Yeah.
person, any client, have a difficult relationship with food that needs to be talked through and processed, right up to the other end of, yes, there's a diagnosable eating disorder here.
Yeah, for sure. That's so true, because we know that there's, on one end of the spectrum, there is diagnosable conditions. And then on the other side of the spectrum, there are people that, like you said, their relationship with food is probably not the healthiest. A lot of people use food as a coping tool to deal with very difficult emotions. Or if something really stressful happens in someone's life, like a fight with someone, or an argument, or a breakup, often food is used to sort of like self-soothe, like especially, and I'm specifically speaking about those, those quote unquote comfort foods like ice cream, chocolates, and cookies, and those types of things. So, yeah, so. And that's, I guess that's the difference, isn't it? Like, disordered eating is not a mental illness. It's different types of behaviors that might not be ideal, but might not meet the full criteria for a specific condition versus a diagnosable condition. Yeah.
And yeah, I think some people get lost into the idea of, I don't have a diagnosis, so therefore I don't need help, which, isn't true. There's so many different experiences of mental health. Take grief, right? So grief, of losing a parent or losing a loved one. We all kind of face these struggles that might need a third party, a professional, to kind of help talk about what's normal in that process. Kind of helpful tips and tricks that might help us think differently about that, or even just express what's going on to get through it in a better way.
Yeah, and that's a good analogy. And I also like to talk to people about thinking about disordered eating and eating disorders, but almost from an addictions lens. Like, for example, we also at Safe Place, we get a lot of people who have issues with drug and alcohol abuse. Sometimes they might willingly tell us, that they have a problem with this. And sometimes maybe they've been convinced or pressured by a loved one to come. Now, some people might minimize, and they might say, look, yeah, I drink from time to time, but it's not really a problem. I'm not addicted. I don't need alcohol to function. But Yeah, you might not be addicted as such, but if you're, for example, every Friday night, getting really drunk and coming home late and having arguments with your partner, and getting involved in fights, then like there's different levels to these things, isn't there? So it's really sometimes I like to talk to clients about eating or disordered eating or eating disorders, but from sort of like an addictions lens as well. Yeah.
And what is that disordered eating, or what does that, I call it the real estate. So the amount of time and energy that your brain is going into thinking about food and restricting or binging and such, what is that getting in the way of? Is it getting in the
Yeah.
way of a healthy relationship? And because I think a lot of eating disorders is quite secretive. People might not actually really know what's going on, or the rule book, or how much time and energy you're putting into getting through the day without eating or skipping meals, etc.
Yeah, and when you said that, the real estate, it made me think of this really cool diagram that I saw when I was doing some training a few years ago, and they were talking about a pie chart. So for example, for a typical brain, the pie chart might get made up of family, relationship, study, work, hobbies, interests, food, it's quite balanced. Whereas with the eating disorder brain, a majority of the real estate is occupied by the food. And with some eating disorders, there is an obsessional nature to them. And that's one of the things about it. People really fixate and obsess, and it really takes up a lot of your mental energy. Yeah.
And the stress that goes with that, right? Or the beating yourself afterwards if you do slip up and, eat something.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, you don't really give much time to anything else. Often, your studies might get impacted. You're not performing well at work. Relationship issues arise. Your life starts to revolve around food, and to the detriment of a lot of other things that, you would typically value and want to maintain. Yeah.
I think that's a really good segue into maybe stigma number one that a lot of people with eating disorders might face, and that is it's a choice, get over it, right? There's this, okay, clearly you've got an issue, but you're choosing that. You're choosing not to eat. You're choosing to, jump on a treadmill for 2 hours a day. Like, that's your choice. So just stop it and everything will be fine.
And often that notion of it's a choice, it's really tricky because, people often will get told by their family, just get over yourself, just eat it. It's not a big deal. Why are you being so difficult for? Like people get told off, because there's a notion that, no, this is a choice. You can control this. But unfortunately, it's not a choice. If it was a choice, it would be so easy to stop it. But it is unfortunately, it is a mental illness ultimately. And similar to anxiety, for example, someone with anxiety might have really catastrophic thinking styles, all or nothing thinking styles, thinking in very black and white terms. And if someone has severe anxiety, simply telling them, oh, don't stress about it, it's nothing, that's not gonna help them. If you're really stressed about something and someone tells you, oh, relax, that's gonna probably make you more stressed. And similar with eating disorders, because people with a lot of eating disorders, it sort of takes over you. There's a lot of people describe it as like a monster within, or there's a part of me that knows the logic behind everything, but then there's the eating disorder part of me that is really worried about, if I eat this, I'm going to gain so much weight, or I'm not lovable if I'm, if I don't weigh under a certain, weight, or and it's not as simple as, yeah, it's not that simple, because these beliefs are really ingrained in one's mind, and it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of therapy, takes a lot of challenging experimentation, exposure. So yeah, it's not as simple as, yeah, just get over it.
Okay. So let's pretend, yeah, a client has first come to you and expressed, and you've done that initial assessment related to eating disorders. What are some key things that you'd like that client to walk away with after revealing that information and revealing that really yucky issue?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because a lot of people feel really nervous to talk about it, especially for the first time. And what I would want the client to walk away from the first session is a sense of hope, because we know that with eating disorders, sometimes they can be quite challenging to overcome. And, usually people aren't presenting right at the beginning of developing this disorder. It's usually been happening for quite a while, and then it's really important to and what I try to do is tell people that it's definitely possible to recover from an eating disorder, and I'm here to help you along the way. But I also do need to be realistic with them and not give them unrealistic expectations, because the difference between counseling for eating disorders versus counseling for like a general issue, it is quite different, because when you're seeing a therapist for a general mental health issue, it is a very client-centered approach. The client sort of leads the session, and we help them along the way. And person-centered care is paramount. With eating disorders, we do the therapist does have to adopt a empathic but firm stance. And the thing about eating disorder treatment is it's not a passive treatment. It's very active. So a lot of work happens in therapy, but a lot of the work happens outside of therapy as well. So there's a lot of behavioral changes that need to be adopted. So it's not as simple as, yeah, you come talk to your therapist for 1 hour, and then next week you see them, and then it's going to be all good. There's a lot of work that needs to happen outside of, like, at home, at work, when you're hanging out with friends, or so I do, but I talk to people about how, look, I understand it's not easy. I'm not gonna be harsh. There's a difference between being very there's a difference between being firm and being harsh, because firm is you sort of need people to take an active role in their recovery, and letting people know that the power is in their hands. But I'm not gonna be a punitive person. I'm not gonna tell people off if they didn't do their homework. But we will ask about what were the barriers, why didn't you do it? How can we increase the chance of you doing it next week, type thing. So that's a really important thing to talk about, because it's not, yeah, it's not a very passive treatment. It is quite active.
And why would you say the firmness is needed, Adam? So, kind of distinguishing from other forms of therapy related to mental health, why is it important for the therapist to be active and firm?
Yeah, because with eating disorders, it depends on a person's readiness and level of motivation. So sometimes we might get people who have been referred, but They don't believe they have a problem. They're not really that keen on addressing it. And then later on, sometimes people start to realize, okay, I do need to address this problem. I do need to start working on this. It's impacting my life too much. But, I don't want to get too nitty-gritty and jargonistic, but we have the stages of change model with pre-contemplation, contemplation, and with eating disorders, people can shift from one stage to the next. And the eating disorder is, in a way, it's serving a purpose for someone, whether that's control, whether that's relief, whether that's comfort. Like the eating disorder, everyone's different, obviously, but the eating disorder is serving a role. It's serving a purpose. And when we try to treat someone for it, it's sort of like the eating disorder, it sets off this panic system. It's sort of like, oh, you need me. You can't live without me. So the person can oscillate between, yes, I want to work on this, but then get really stressed about it, panicked about it, have, the eating disorder might play tricks on, you by saying, look, it's not that bad. So what? You skip a few meals, it's not that big of a deal. So that's why the firmness is needed, because if we remained passive, the eating disorder essentially would win. Like, we need to challenge the eating disorder, and we need to differentiate the eating disorder part of us versus the healthy part of us. And it's that constant tension, that battle within.
Which can be really difficult for some therapists who might not have had a lot of experience with eating disorders or people who have an eating disorder in terms of carving out that safety in the relationship to go, hey, you came to me with this problem and I need to kind of ask some challenging questions here, or I need to kind of say, hey, you're doing this thing, but we kind of talked about this thing, and that's a tricky thing to hold space for.
Exactly. And whenever you have a session with someone, it's always life happens, and it's really important to devote some time for regular life things, but we still need to get back to the eating disorder, because if we didn't do that, it would never get addressed, really. It would it's really tricky to stay on track, but it's really important to make a conscious effort to do that. And that's why the therapist's role is so important, because as a client, you often don't want to go to that dark place. It's easier to talk about whatever is happening in your life, because they're easier to talk about. Whereas if we remained in a supportive talk therapy type of state, the hour would get used up, and before you know it, we haven't even touched on it again.
And this kind of really taps into the secrecy that goes on usually, maybe not always, but usually there's elements of not sharing with other people about how bad it is, isolating themselves, doing this kind of narrative of everything is fine when it's not fine, but really having a professional who knows the signs of what's not good and what's not healthy and what is the kind of journey ahead for that person if they continue to do those unhealthy behaviors, just to kind of keep a client on track and going in a certain way.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, so there's a nice segue here to really kind of delve a little bit more into different models of therapy that you think are good for eating disorders, Adam. What's the approach that you take with clients?
Yeah, so there are different approaches out there, different models and evidence-based modalities out there. There is CBTE, which is cognitive, so it's enhanced cognitive behavior therapy, which is like the regular CBT, but this is more focused on the eating disorder. So targeting the eating disorder cognitions and behaviors. It's quite structured, and it's a good model actually. But for people who don't want to have such a structured or rigid model, there's also SSCM, which stands for Specialist Supportive Clinical Management, which is a really flexible approach, that combines eating disorder management with psychotherapy. So it allows us to target the eating disorder, but it also gives us scope to address any other life problems that someone might be going through, that could be connected to the eating disorder but might not be. So I've done training in both CBTE and SSCM, and I feel like those two are quite good models that I enjoy using. And then there are lots of other models out there as well, but there's one called Mantra, there's one called FBT. But at the moment, I'm focusing on those two. Sometimes you can get a bit, you can go a bit overboard with, training in so many different models.
Totally. And I'm sure just having those two, there would be quite a mix of tools that you can use and
Definitely.
in that you can use with different client presentations.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
As we've been talking today, I guess I'm kind of thinking about who would be tuning into this episode. It could be a person themselves worrying that they might have an eating disorder and wanting to reach out for help. But it also might be a loved one who is concerned about a family member who they think might have an eating disorder. And I don't think it's any surprise here to kind of share this concept of people with eating disorder having this really big defensive wall up, stopping reaching out for help, or even stopping the conversation to talk about I have a problem, like this is an actual problem for me. And a lot of that goes into the how an eating disorder mental health issue starts, right? There's this internal critic, there's this kind of internal stuff building and building and building that builds this idea that I have to restrict, I have to exercise religiously, etc. And I'm wondering, do you have any tips for a family member who might be worried about a loved one, and what are some kind of chat discussions they can raise to kind of bypass the defensive wall?
I think so. I think so because I like to with eating disorders, it's quite similar to addiction in a way, because there is a lot of secrecy and shame and defensiveness. But in addition to that, sometimes people might not acknowledge that they have a problem. And we look at, with eating disorders or addictions for that matter, there are different phases. For example, then the first phase is it could be along the lines of, I don't have a problem. I don't think, yeah, there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't have a problem. And then that could lead into, I might have a problem, yeah, but it's not that bad. It's under control. It's not affecting me. That could lead into, look, I do have a problem, but whatever, I don't care. It is what it is. And then that could lead into, I want to change, but I don't know how. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. and then and so forth and so on and so forth. And for family members, it can be really, really tricky because if you think about it, if you try to bring something up with someone, you don't really know how they're going to react. They might be very defensive. They might get angry, get upset. They might deny it. And then that can leave you feeling very stuck. Where do I go from here? There's a few things that I could talk about. The first thing is for family members, I would definitely recommend getting in touch with eating disorder helplines. So I know in Victoria, I don't know if it's Australia wide actually. So I don't want to say if it's Australia wide, but at least in Victoria, there's the Butterfly Foundation. And they have a phone helpline for people with an eating disorder, as well as family members or loved ones, where they can get some really good emotional support, advice, and they can lead you in the right direction. So that is definitely a really good option. But also, as family members or loved ones, if you're thinking that, someone you care about has an eating disorder, or you're worried that it might be the case, we want to start the conversation in a gentle way. We don't want someone to feel criticized or under attack, because that naturally leads to defensiveness. So we want a gentle conversation starter, because we need to remember that the person with the eating disorder likely has a lot of shame associated with it, and it can be very embarrassing or difficult to talk about. But if someone is not acknowledging that they might have a problem, what you could do is try to create a sense of ambivalence within them. So, for example, if someone is not acknowledging that they have a problem, or if they're acknowledging that they do have an eating disorder, but they're denying that it's a problem, we call that pre-contemplation. That is a stage of change where you don't think there's anything wrong with you. And in therapy talk, what the therapist is what the therapist needs to do is engage in motivational interviewing to try to create a sense of ambivalence in that person, to help them realize that, well, to help them get to a stage where they want to address the problem. So, for example, let's just say there is a 24-year-old woman, and her mum has tried to talk to her about it because she's worried about maybe mum has noticed that she's getting quite skinny. She's not eating much. Her portion sizes are really small, but she's denying that there's a problem at all. We know that some people with eating disorders struggle with their periods. Maybe they don't have regular periods, or maybe they haven't had a period in a long time. So maybe her mum could say to her, just curious, when have you had your period lately? Or when was the last time you had your period? Now, if she's still having regular periods, then she can say, oh yeah, I just had it a few weeks ago. Why? And but that could turn into a conversation starter. That and she could say possibly, oh, why do you ask? And then mum could say, well, I just checking, because sometimes when people restrict, or they're not eating as much, or you don't even have to use the eating disorder word, because that can be quite triggering, or that could set them off into defensiveness. But But just the conversation about how sometimes restriction or excessive weight loss can affect, can delay a period or stop a woman from having her period. And then it could turn into a conversation about fertility. You know, especially if a woman has ambitions to have children one day. So, you know, this is just to plant the seeds and to get people to realize that it might not be a problem now, but it can be a problem for your life moving forward.
And I guess there's an invitation there to come out of that tunnel that the brain, you know, we're making some guesses here, but if they do have an eating disorder, usually there it's like there's a tunnel going on, that there's this very one-track mind of I need to lose weight. If someone challenges me, they're wrong, or they're the bad guy, or they're not there to help me, that kind of thing. But opening their brain to, what are the problems going on right now, or could happen down the track for them to contemplate.
Exactly. Another example could be a young man who is going to the gym quite frequently. But he might be working out really intensely, like extreme. And we know with fitness and gym and working out, nutrition is really, really, really important because you want your muscles to recover, you want your body to recover. And, you know, maybe this hypothetical guy is going to the gym quite frequently, but isn't noticing any gains. So that could even be a conversation starter about, you know, you've been going to the gym for 6 months now. How do you think your progress is going? You know, so because it really does affect many different aspects of your life. So if people can find little, you know, avenues to broach these topics that don't automatically start with, I'm worried about your eating disorder, or I'm worried that you might have an eating disorder, because that will automatically set someone on defense mode.
And I guess if we think about therapy, let's kind of go to the drinking idea and the person feeling that they have to drink to get up, they have to drink to cope with work or cope with family or stress. And, you know, therapy or recovery is all about taking that actually away, which can be so scary, right? So scary. I don't have anything else. Nothing in my life feels stable or that I could go to for help, but I do have this one thing. So it's
And sorry to interrupt, but
that's
that
fine.
one thing is the ultimate control that you have.
Exactly. So that's why this kind of slow steps, being a little bit strategic in the conversations we have with these loved ones, but also getting that personal help that you said before.
Exactly, because with eating disorder recovery, it's important to recognize that it is a long journey. And it's important to have patience, because there will be setbacks along the way. It's natural to expect that, but it's important to remember that recovery is not a straight line. It will go up and down, back, forward. So it's important to be aware of that, to not get disheartened, if, you know, maybe you're not recovering quick enough, or you know, you've had a bit of a slip up. That's okay. That's okay. Just keep moving forward. Don't let it bog you down. Keep trying. You know, you'll make mistakes along the way, but mistakes help you learn lessons. So it's really important that we follow a pace and not try to just rush into it and, you know, set unrealistic expectations.
Yeah. And whether it is a family member feeling very isolated and alone in that problem with seeing their loved one go through something horrible, or with someone themselves who might think they have an eating disorder or disordered eating problem, we want to really break down that isolation. We really want, even if someone comes for one or two sessions just to test it out and actually share what's going on in their head, they don't have to do anything else. That can be helping them along that kind of change wheel to, maybe I do have a problem, or maybe I need to at least assess what is my trigger for help if it escalates.
And I just thought of something as well, where sometimes making that decision can be quite daunting to get help. And sometimes people will eventually decide, okay, I'm gonna do it now. And then maybe the health professional that they go to, maybe the person that's attending that appointment doesn't feel heard or understood, or maybe feels dismissed or judged. And that can be quite off-putting, and that could turn them off seeing it ever again. But it's really important to remember that if you have one negative experience with one professional, that paint the whole, system with that type of treatment. So if you don't have a good experience with one person, go to another or go to someone else, because there are so many good therapists out there. You just need to find a right match for you. And before you make your appointment with anyone, it's worth, like calling, your doctor or a psychologist or a counselor or social worker or psychiatrist, whatever it is. It's important to have a chat to them before you book your first appointment. Just check, are you happy to work with eating disorders? Because some people might not be, and then you can find someone else.
I think that's also another good point that I think a lot of clients feel that they have to share everything in a first session, or that they have to tell their whole life story. Say the old, we don't have to do Freud here, right? We don't have to talk about mum and dad stuff. That's okay. But what would it be like for you to share 5%? What would it be like for you to share what is a day in your life like in your head? That is a really interesting session that if we understand that and then understand what the problems you face as part of having a yucky voice in your head or having real negative thoughts or whatever it is that makes life a struggle, let's start there.
For sure. For sure.
And I guess that's my main takeaway today is all mental health, there is a journey, but particularly for eating disordered or disordered eating, it has been ingrained for usually a very, very, very long time. And that takes time to dismantle that. It takes time to trust a professional to take those first steps. But getting that help is really important. It's based on physical health and mental health. Cool. Well, thank you for your time, Adam. It's been
Pleasure.
a really nice conversation. So if you're watching this or listening in, want some more information, we do have our website in the description box below. Reach out to our service or look at some of other videos through YouTube. There's lots of really good information out there. We flagged the Butterfly Foundation to get some more help. But please think about your headspace, what's going on, and the kind of support that you might need. But thank you and bye for now.